Welcome back to another episode of Mistakes, Missteps, and Mindsets, stories of failure and resilience in academic research. My name is Alex White Guerriero, and I am here with my co-host today,
Dr. Crystal Nunes. On today's episode, we have Elise Como. She is a PhD candidate in geography and planning at the University of Toronto. She is an urban planner interested in transportation policy, planning, and equity. Her current research focuses on the intersection of transportation planning and accessibility, and her dissertation work is specifically focused on accessible student transportation. She works as a research affiliate in the Engagement and Planning for Inclusive Communities Lab, or the EPIC Lab, at Holland Bloor Kids Rehabilitation Hospital. And previously, she worked at Sajeki Planning as an urban planner and is also TMU alum, receiving her Master's of Planning in Urban Development in 2018. Welcome to the podcast, Elise.
Thanks so much for having me, and thanks for that great intro.
So Elise, can you describe for our listeners your area of expertise and what the goals are of your current research?
Yeah, for sure. So as you mentioned in the intro, I'm an urban planner by practice, and my research, broadly speaking, focuses on the intersection of transportation planning and accessibility. And right now I'm in my PhD, and my doctoral work is focused on how it's accessible transportation to school, but it's specifically focused on how kids with disabilities are traveling to school and the challenges that they may encounter in their journeys. So from the experiential side and also from the organizational side of school transportation. And I guess the objective of my research and of this work as a whole would be to address the gap in both practice and policymaking when it comes to providing equitable and accessible transportation for all bodies, including individuals with disabilities and mobility impairments.
That's amazing. Are you working with children kindergarten through grade 12, or do you have a focus of your research?
So part of my data analysis is actually looking at data that my supervisor gathered when he was in his PhD program, and he actually interviewed families living with disabilities as well as children. So that's part of it. And my interviews are specifically focused on school travel practitioners. So school board staff. So basically, yeah, focusing on how school transport is organized at an institutional level.
Okay.
So we get to see kind of both sides of how it's experienced on the ground and then how it's organized, you know, in a policy setting.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that's really interesting.
So, Elise, when did you realize you were interested in urban planning? Was this always something that you were like, wow, I really want to get into streets, or were you kind of just brought into it in an organic or inorganic way?
I would say quite inorganic. I mean, I always loved to play Sims when I was a kid, SimCity, if that counts.
Amazing.
But, I can pretty much say with certainty that it wasn't always a career goal of mine. Firstly, because I didn't even know it was a career to begin with. I always thought of, you know, architects, urban designers, engineers, but never urban planners, and they're kind of in the middle of that spectrum. And how it came about was a good friend of mine at U of T when I was in undergrad, I think it was in third year, she was taking an elective, and she's like, Elise, you should take this with me. It's I think it was the geography of China, but it was very much focused on development in China and the urban planning, how it came about. So I took it, and I became fascinated with, wow, this is a career. This could be a great option for me. And yeah, it kind of fits in. I was always interested in global development, like how cities develop over time, but never put two and two together. And I always just associated it with, you know, working at the UN or WHO and those types of organizations seem so out of reach to me, especially as a teen.
And a Canadian.
Yeah, exactly. And like you need, you know, I always assumed, oh, you need connections to get into that type of global development work. So yeah, so I kind of discovered it, I guess, in undergrad.
Yeah, awesome.
I think that really highlights the value of, sure, having the courses tied to your major during your undergrad, but also leaving yourself open to those other opportunities that you might not have previously considered, or those elective courses can really change your trajectory. I might have mentioned this in a past episode, but I, in my undergrad, was a physical geography major and then took a few biology courses, loved it, added it as my minor, and then ended up pursuing that field for my PhD. Even as an elective, I remember taking Canadian history because it fit in my schedule, no other reason, and I was kind of dreading it at the time. And I ended up thinking it was such an interesting course. We got to go to the Archives of Ontario and scroll through old documents and do some really interesting assignments. Now, I'm not a historian today, but I can still appreciate that experience of being in that class that I probably would have not previously considered. So again, undergraduate focused audience here, I think it's another great example of being open to courses you might not have considered.
I that's actually something that at U of T, like they call it the breadth requirements, where you have to take your arts, your science, your math. And I think that's such a wonderful thing because it really does push you to do something that you wouldn't do, like art history kids taking a physics class.
Sure.
Exactly.
And my sister, she did art history at U of T. She took her physics class. She loved it. She was like, this is the best thing I've ever done. Not a person who would ever like think to do physics, but she loved that class. And I think it's so important. I took politics this semester and I love, like I maybe want to be like an environmental lawyer or go into policy now, because I think it's just such an interesting and cool thing to like study. And I would never have done that if I didn't take that politics class.
Exactly. They open up your mind to what's out there, because we don't always know what's at our disposal. Yeah.
I will first say, Alex, that I appreciate that goal, because we need scientists in policy making. My goodness. And also, I teach first year biology here at TMU, and in the fall iteration of the course, there are many students from computer science, from engineering, who have to take the class as a requirement. And it was so heartwarming at the end of term, having some students come up to me saying, you know, I'll probably never see you again because I don't have to take any more biology, but I surprisingly really like this course. Yeah. I appreciate that. So,
that's great.
Yeah.
Would you mind walking us briefly through your academic journey?
Yes, absolutely. So I started at U of T for my undergrad. And again, going off the global development theme, I was thinking of going into international relations. And U of T had a pretty good program. So I applied, got in. And once I was there, I realized, and as part of that program, you take a lot of different courses, so history courses, politics, economics, and so it was a nice variety, but I kind of got lost because it was so broad. And I can speak to this a bit later as well, but yeah, so I ended up with a major in political science and a double minor in human geography and history. Okay. So it was a bit of a mishmash of all the courses I took over those 4 years. So again, I think it speaks to, you know, finding urban planning, which was under the umbrella of human geography. And so finding that in my third year, and I just took all the courses I could in that field. And so I ended up with a minor in that field, even though it wasn't my intention from the get-go. And then afterwards, after realizing that I wanted to be a planner, it became quite streamlined what would be next for me. And so I had to do a master's, because the field itself, you either do an undergrad in planning from an accredited program, there's only a few, or you have to do the master's to get an accredited master's program in planning. So I looked to TMU because their program was super hands-on, and I knew I wanted to go work afterwards. Mm-hmm. And so their program was really designed to, you know, prepare you for the workforce, and I wanted to go into consulting. So I started at TMU, and I graduated in 2018, and it was, I have all good things to say about the program. It's amazing. And then I entered the field, worked for 3 years as a planning consultant in Toronto. So I've been in Toronto for this whole time. And then during COVID, I decided to go back to academia. So not very linear, kind of all over the place. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and so I'm doing my PhD in planning, focus on transportation at the University of Toronto now. And I'm hoping to graduate next year, June 2025.
Best of luck.
Yeah. Fingers That's crossed.
So within planning, there's sort of specializations, and you're specializing in accessibility of transportation. What was the sort of catalyst for that?
Yeah, I think, well, when I was working as a planner, a lot of our projects focused on TODs, so transit-oriented developments, mm-hmm. is what they're called. So master planning around GO train stations, that's a good example of what a TOD is. And it came to my, I mean, it wasn't a huge revelation because I knew that accessibility was an afterthought in a lot of, you know, design interventions. And it became quite apparent just, you know, doing the day-to-day work and seeing that accessibility is an afterthought and not really knowing where it fits in. And also not being very trained on accessibility. It's not a core course in the planning curriculum. Mm. And so I became very attached to that idea and that issue or that research gap that there's a lack of accessibility in our training and also in our practice. So that's really what led me to the PhD. I don't know that I would have gotten there if I didn't work in the field beforehand. Yep. Because in my master's, I was working on research with Dr. Sweet, who teaches in the planning program. And we were focused on autonomous vehicles in Toronto and how to accommodate, how our streets can accommodate autonomous vehicles. Yeah. So not accessibility focused. And so this interest in accessibility came throughout my practicing years, really.
I can say, I mean, anytime I've had like a sprain, well, I was on crutches a couple summers ago, and I will say like getting around the city, and that was just a temporary situation. That was right. Only a couple weeks, but getting around Toronto is
so difficult
if you don't have all four of your limbs working in the proper way. Like,
yep.
I couldn't believe it. The stair, like everything is stairs. Almost none of the elevators even work half the time.
Yeah, exactly.
Escalators are kind of dicey, yep. You know, it's crazy. And people aren't willing to help a lot of the time. And mm-hmm. it's funny because I would say Toronto is like a pretty friendly city most yeah. of the time. But like there would be times I'd be standing with my crutches on the TTC being like, hi, can I please sit for a moment? Yeah. Or just like kind of like fall over. And eventually they would be like, oh, here. And I'd be like, thanks.
Just feeling very helpless in mm-hmm. a way, and that there's no accommodations and being made.
Yeah, yeah, it's so frustrating. And I cannot relate to that experience of it every day, but it is, you do start to see the city differently when you do yes. experience something like that. Like going outside is hard. It's a mission.
Absolutely. It's a mission. And curb cuts and any, you know, yeah. ramps getting into like the stop gap to get into mm-hmm. stores. Mm-hmm. You know, we see them sometimes, but not always. Yep. It's not a given. Yeah. Stairs are a huge issue.
And the yeah. stopgap program, isn't it like a free program that businesses can sign up for, or they have to fundraise? I think it depends on the BIA.
Yeah, I'm not yeah. too sure. It probably, yeah, I think it does depend on the BIA, but it's very, like, it's not hard to do. I think yeah. it's just political will. And
yeah.
So forth.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I think you're absolutely right in that I'm someone who's so lucky and so privileged to not have day-to-day mobility issues, so I don't often have to think about it. Mm-hmm. But then there are times, your example with a sprained ankle, for me as simple as There's one time I was transporting a lot of boxes on a dolly, and I suddenly needed to find where is the ramp to get into this building. And it's in those moments where you realize, wow, the things that I take for granted every time of hopping up these three steps, how I need to troubleshoot this. And it goes back to the idea of when you design an accessible city, it benefits everyone. It's not just for those people that have mobility issues. Everyone can make use of a ramp, those with a temporary injury, people with baby strollers, or whatever it might be. And I've seen the maps, even in the city of Toronto, where they will say, highlight the accessible subway stations. You know where you can get off if you require that accessibility. It's pretty unbelievable. What if you need to get off at a stop in between? You don't have that option. So now the subway line that exists for every other Torontonian is so minimalized for those with accessibility issues.
Yeah, your city becomes that much smaller. Exactly. When you aren't, you know, when there's no accommodations for you, you have to, where you can go is so limited. Mm-hmm. And so it's, in a way, I mean, I can talk about this for hours, but it's a human rights issue.
It is
right to the city, right?
Yeah.
And it's if this whole segment of the population, whether you have a stroller, whether you're on crutches, whether you have a wheelchair or cane, if they can't access the city and recreation areas, education, employment, it's a human rights issue. It's just, you know, it's wrong.
Oh, absolutely. I think you might have alluded to this in one of your past answers, but as you know, on our podcast, we like to highlight failures that we've all experienced and the valuable lessons that can be learned from that. With that in mind, can you tell us about a time where you've experienced a failure, whether it's from your undergraduate degree, your master's, maybe your current research as a PhD candidate?
Yeah, absolutely. Even though there will be inevitably bumps in the road throughout any grad program or even any job, I'd say the failure, and I have thought about this quite a bit in the past couple days, but the biggest failure that had a significant impact on me personally happened in undergrad. Mm-hmm. So while I was at U of T, and it had to do with language. So my first language is French, second language English, and it may sound a bit silly, but I've been living in Ontario for quite a while, but communication in English is much different to academic writing in English, and this became very apparent when I enrolled at U of T, and a lot of my courses were essay-based, and so here I am trying to communicate these thoughts and lines of argumentation in English, and all of the ideas were there, but the sentence structure was just completely off. And because all of these courses were mostly essay based in my first 2 years, my marks were not great. And it was the first time that I felt like I was struggling in school, because both my primary school and secondary school were full French. And so this was a big moment for me where I had to reevaluate, like, do I belong here? I know I want to pursue university, but is this, can I do this? Can I, if I want to do a master's, I need to turn my grades around, quite frankly. And so this failure, naturally, I had to revisit my intentions, and I thought maybe I should transfer schools to McGill or somewhere where I can submit all of my work in French.
Right.
And yeah, it was just a terrifying moment because I had made a lot of friends at U of T, and, you know, as a 19, 20 year old, it's scary to leave a community you've just
built.
Built from the ground up. And I was really leaning on them for support. So I'd say that was a big blow to my confidence. And yeah, basically I had to make a decision on what to do next.
It's very tricky because I think that we as people, like, as an, I don't speak French. So I'm like, oh, speaking French, what a fantastic asset. But then I know my partner, he was French immersion all mm-hmm. through high school and elementary school, but he really struggled similarly in university because yeah. it's especially with math, because right. it's oh. kind of it, yeah, math and science, which they're like, oh, those are like the universal languages. Math's the universal language.
Yeah.
And he's like, but suddenly they were using terms and
oh, yes,
things I didn't know. And yep. I couldn't like figure it out in my head. Like, what am I supposed to be doing here?
Exactly.
And it's like, it, you really do have to like reevaluate how to, like, it's, I can't even grasp it because I don't speak another language, but just the idea of like someone saying something to you and then you having to think about it and then turn it around and be like, okay, mm-hmm. and now I have to say it back to them and the way that they said it. And you're like, what yeah. am I saying?
It's and really... especially like in a sophisticated way if oh, you're yeah. in university
yeah,
too.
So exactly. that
was, because it was a bit strange because I knew I could speak well
mm-hmm.
and I don't know. I don't know if I have an accent, but I've been here for a while and I'm used to living in English, mm-hmm. but having to kind of rewire your brain yeah. in a way.
Yeah. It's okay. like academic writing too, like especially yes. papers and stuff. It is its own language. It, yes. There is a specific
it's a skill.
Way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You read my mind. I was thinking the same thing in that I recognize the challenges that, say, a lot of international students have mm-hmm. in my classes, or again, those where English is not their first language. That challenge alone, which, again, I don't speak a second language, so I can't even imagine navigating. On top of that, then having to learn a specific writing style, because scientific writing is just so
exactly.
different. Yeah. From everyday writing.
Face. For those who couldn't see, I just made a disgusted scrunchy face. but you know what? That struggle with academic writing got me in your office, so it was worth it.
There you go.
That's great.
So with that feeling sort of like, I don't belong here, I shouldn't be here, I need to reevaluate everything, I need to leave, how did you respond to that? What was your... We know your initial response, but what was your bounce back?
Yeah, absolutely. So how did I respond? The first initial response, which would be when I would walk back to res or to my apartment with these essays that were completely marked up, I would lean on my friends that I had made. And luckily, they were brilliant writers. So I had a friend group that loved to write, and they were super willing to help me proofread my essays. So once the issue was identified, I took advantage also of resources on campus, like mm-hmm. the Writing Center
oh, yeah.
that was associated with my college. And I still think back at the staff who helped me. It was always the same staff at the Writing Center. And I owe so much to that person because it was just, you know, I'd go with my essay drafts and she would help me mark things up and mm-hmm. clarify things that weren't communicated properly in English, but in my head they made sense. She's like, oh, maybe we say it this way. And so just getting in the groove of that and the sentence structure and all of these skills that she helped me with,
mm-hmm.
that changed everything. My grades started getting a lot better quite quickly. So the whole situation was quite humbling. And when I did receive, you know, these grades that were increasingly getting better, I felt very encouraged and determined mm-hmm. to just get really great at writing.
Yeah.
And so it became like a project, I guess. And I still had time to turn it around, which is really important in the story because this all happened in my first and second year.
Mm-hmm.
So I still had two more years to improve and to, you know, if I wanted to get into grad school, which inevitably I had to for planning, my third and my fourth year were super important to kind of show that I had this improving transcript with
mm-hmm.
all of my essay-based courses. So yeah, even though it was a while ago, I still think it defines how I approach things, whether it be through practice or research. I'm naturally very hard on myself,
mm. yep.
but I think that's like a theme in academia.
Yeah.
But it's also what pushes me forward, so that the drive to be better and to improve and just to keep moving and going and keeping an open mind and saying yes to opportunities. So when I reflect on it now, I can see it as a negative situation, which then transformed itself into a pretty positive one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, seeing that I can take this weakness and turn it into strength, and it requires time and effort. And yeah, something I love to do now is write, and I'm pursuing a PhD. So that's, if like 19-year-old me knew that, she'd laugh. So yeah, when I feel stuck, sometimes I think about it. I think back at how I felt in undergrad and mm-hmm. how I felt pretty defeated. But, you know, it takes a village, and it was my friends and the resources on campus and just the maybe stubbornness to want to get it right.
Yes, sure. Absolutely. Yep. Spite too, sometimes.
Yeah, exactly.
It's one of my favorite motivators. When yes. I do bad on something, I'm like, well, I'm going to do really good on the next one.
Exactly.
I'll show you.
Yeah.
There were so many things in that story that I latched onto. Mm-hmm. Firstly, that you were proud of yourself to see the improvement in your mm-hmm. transcript. Oh, absolutely. I've said this before and I'll say it again. When I look at applications of potential students joining our research group, I don't care if you had poor grades at the beginning of your undergraduate journey. What I'm looking for is that growth and improvement. Exactly. And that's what matters. I also love that you went to the Writing Center. I've recommended that to many students.
Oh, great.
So hopefully many will take me up on that advice, because I think it is a very valuable and perhaps underutilized yep. resource at the university. And the third thing was that you received your work back with the markups and all the comments, and you didn't just toss it aside or throw right. it in a recycling bin, which can be the case for some students. But taking that time to reflect on that feedback, improve your writing, proofread, getting a second pair of eyes on it, it can be so valuable. And writing is a skill, and it yeah. will absolutely improve over time. Mm-hmm. I'm reminded of my own undergraduate degree, where a good friend of mine and I went to the same university, started first year together, and he would frequently ask me, you know, hey, can you edit my assignment yeah. for me? It was a little bit rough in the beginning. I had a lot of comments, a lot of track changes in those Word documents. And it was a challenge to read through them at the beginning. But I think even without him maybe even realizing it, as he was seeing my comments and how I rephrase things, he's picking up those skills. And it was the following year where we had another class together, same request, hey, can you edit my work for me a year later? It was night and day. I couldn't right. believe it was mm-hmm. the same person yep. who in first year I had edited their work, and his improvement over that time was fantastic.
Right.
I'm very fortunate that Kyle is in publishing, and so proofreading all of my work is very very much a key part of my process. But even he says, like, from second year when I was writing it, and all of the like syntax errors and sure, like right. choice, word choice, and sometimes I would just skip a word completely because I guess when I'm typing I'm just like moving faster than my brain can process. And he has no, like, he does not know what I'm talking about in these essays, but to be like, hey, this is this thing, hey, I looked up the use of this word, you should use it this way instead of this way. And then to have it, like, I send it off and it'll be like 76 comments. Mm-hmm. And now it's like 5.
There
and
you I'm
like,
that's amazing.
Baller. Feels great.
What advice might you have for, say, an undergraduate student listening to this podcast that's facing their own challenges and where they could turn for support? I think you gave a few examples in your own story from a moment ago.
Yeah, absolutely. I think leaning on TAs and profs that want to see you grow and succeed, and to not be shy to build those relationships with both profs and TAs. I know it can be intimidating at first, but and it's easier said than done. But for me, I, you know, force myself out of my comfort zone to build those relationships and to be honest when I was struggling. And the feedback I received and the help I received was always super great and very encouraging. And so that would be my first kind of line of defense. you know, build those relationships with your professors and your TAs. And especially if you're thinking about going to grad school, that will help you as well with reference letters. Mm-hmm. You know, that became on my mind in my third year. I was telling myself, okay, if I'm going to go do a master's, I'll need reference letters from profs that know me. And so I started building relationships, and I still keep in touch with some of those profs. So it's really great. They've become mentors. And yeah, I feel like it just humanizes the whole thing. Like a TA and a prof were in your shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And
absolutely,
sometimes not that long ago, especially for TAs. And so to not be so, I guess, intimidated by the whole hierarchy of academia, which can be a bit tricky to navigate sometimes. And I think the other advice I would give is, because my path wasn't very linear, it was meandering more so, I think it's important to highlight that it's never too late to change your plans. Mm-hmm. So even if you think your career is going to look one way, it's okay if you decide to change that. And it's, in a way, it's great to change. And there's so much growth in change. And so I try to encourage myself. Again, I should take my own advice. Like, it's whenever things go not according to plan, I have a reaction, and then I have to kind of, you know, rewind a bit and say, okay, no, this is good, this is growth, this is a lesson, and then you move on. So yeah, I think it's important to embrace the uncertainty of whether it's going into your field or staying in academia, just to say yes and be open to opportunities.
Yeah, definitely the TAs are so critically important in those huge first year courses, because they're often the face of the course for those students. Mm-hmm, they're that main point of contact, where otherwise they're sitting in a room of a few hundred students, sometimes over 1,000.
I was going to say a few hundred.
Yes, exactly. And I so appreciate you highlighting the importance of humanizing these interactions, because that is one of the goals of our podcast, bringing on faculty, TMU alum, such as yourself, and perhaps a student could see themselves in your story or recognize the name of, oh, that's my professor from one of my courses. And then it all just doesn't seem as scary anymore.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I know every week I change what I'm going to be doing a master's or having a job in, and deciding on post-graduation pathways can be very overwhelming.
Yes.
Do you have, or what advice do you have for students who may not know what they would like to pursue post-graduation?
Yes, that's a great question. I think the high-level advice that I would give is to be flexible with the plans that you make for yourself. When issues arise, it's easy to just throw in the towel.
Mm-hmm.
So we learn the most from our failures and our mistakes, I think. It's a little cliche, but I believe it to be quite accurate so far, at least, that, you know, when things get hard, that's when you're really growing and you're learning about yourself and what you want to do, and what you want to, you know, whether it's dedicate your life to a certain topic that you're passionate about. And yeah, on that line of thinking, if you do have a topic that you're passionate about, which is lucky, and if there's a job that is in line with that topic or an issue that you dream of solving, you should go after it and don't underestimate yourself. There's, you know, we think of jobs that are very impactful and we think about them as so out of reach, but a lot of times the impactful jobs are the jobs that are on the ground, and they're, you know, you're engaging with the community every day and kind of on the front lines of whatever field you're in. And so impact is also a term to, I guess, debunk. Like, impact doesn't need to be this big glorious thing. It can be small scale. And I think in planning and in my field, we really, and TMU really engages with that topic of community engagement and the benefits of engaging early with communities and building trust, relationship building, just all of these things. I'm going off tangent a bit, but
tangent away.
Yeah.
We love a tangent.
And yeah, I guess off of that tangent, there would be advice. I think that that's quite valuable, and that's around relationship building. Mm-hmm. So as I mentioned earlier, finding mentors or profs or TAs even that you can be open with and that believe in you and be honest with them and, you know, build that rapport. And if you are to pursue academia, your supervisor is very important in your trajectory and in your success. Mm-hmm. And so, and this was advice that was given to me when I was applying for the PhD, but it's crucial to find a supervisor that is someone that you'll enjoy working with, mm-hmm. because it's teamwork, right? And you're helping them with their research, they're helping you with yours, and it can be a really wonderful thing.
Oh, absolutely. I started my graduate career as a master's student and then decided to do the shift to the PhD stream, mm-hmm. after my first year. And that decision was made in no small part due to the relationship that I had with my supervisor. So I liked the research I was doing. I liked the environment, my colleagues, but I could also see myself working effectively with my supervisor for an additional 4 years. So important.
Yeah. Surround yourself with cool people, but like people that you think are cool, not by definition cool, but people that you're like, I could listen to you talk all day. We could have a fantastic conversation.
Mm.
Find your cheerleaders, find the people in the room that are going to go to bat for you and that you would go to bat for,
exactly.
You know, because that's going to make everything a lot easier, a lot more enjoyable.
Elise, thank you so much for joining us on our podcast. This was a great discussion. I too could go on for hours about accessibility in our city. It's a fascinating topic. It's great work that you're doing. At the end of every podcast, we like to invite our guests to share current projects or resources, anything you would like to highlight for an undergraduate-focused audience.
I'm working on accessible taxis through this project in our lab right now, and we've published one paper on it, and the second one is going to be published probably in the next year. But if you want to learn more about just accessibility in Toronto. This one's focused on taxis, but there's a lot of interesting work coming out of the lab. So I'd encourage you to visit our website and check all of our publications. A lot of it is also around pediatrics and just accessibility in healthcare, because we are based out of a hospital. Keep yourself open to different opportunities and different topics that you may have never thought about. Mm-hmm. And also, my door is always open to chat and brainstorm if you're feeling lost in an undergrad program or not sure if you want to go into practice or grad school. I had a lot of great mentors throughout my academic journey and continue to consult with them, and I'm always hoping to give back in that same way.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you're going to be done your PhD soon.
Hopefully.
And then you're going to be the mentor.
Hopefully.
And if we could just do a final highlight, what is your lab's website? How can students find that?
It's through the Holland Bloorview website. Link is, I guess, just look up Epic Lab at Holland Bloorview.
So again, that's the Engagement and Planning for Inclusive Communities Lab, or the Epic Lab at Holland Bloorview Kids Rehabilitation Hospital. Thank you again so much, Elise, for your time.
Thank you both.
Thanks.
And that is a wrap on another episode of Mistakes, Missteps, and Mindsets. We hope you enjoyed. As always, we would like to extend our thank yous to Toronto Metropolitan University for hosting us, the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council for making this podcast a reality, as well as Kyle Andrews for putting together our wonderful theme music. Most importantly, we would like to thank you guys for listening, and I can't wait for you to come fail with us again next week. See you then. Bye.